Dear John, I hope you are well. I always reflect fondly on our long walks through Tokyo, our discussions and our discourse on what I think are some of the most important topics of our time. You know, I just had a shower, and for me it's quite an important time of my day, really, because it is it's a time of peace. You know, you're in the shower room, there's the steam and the water, there's no phone, there's no digital devices, but you're just there by yourself, literally naked. And I was just thinking before how there's something about that, just a little bit, that seems to connect back to the vast tradition of people like John the Baptist, of the ritual bathing, of washing, the Jordan River, the Euphrates, the Ganges, all of these places where the water and the body meet. And I wonder, you know, is that not the same kind of thing? Because for me, that's a time when I think about things. Ideas come to me. You know, it's kind of a meme, right? Shower thoughts. And the thought that was that came to me was I was reflecting on an idea that's kind of been nagging at me for a few weeks, which is really what am I doing? What am I doing here? What is my vocation? What am I supposed to do? These kinds of things. And maybe you would say to me, John, that Cody, you're doing the right thing. Just keep on going. And I understand that, I think, at a cerebral level. But on a day-to-day basis, you know, I struggle sometimes. I don't know what I'm doing. And I realized maybe what it is that I am a man in search of a mountain. That is to say, I need a challenge. I've never felt comfortable with the status quo or of business as usual or just sort of cruising. In fact, it makes me very uncomfortable. And maybe that's some deep-seated personal thing. Maybe that's my cultural background of, you know, working and trying to be productive. Maybe you could call it the Protestant work ethic, perhaps. But being idle, being lazy, being restless, it all feels very strange and uncomfortable for me. But when I'm dealing with an emergency or a situation, I snap into action and I'm able to resolve it. I'm able to apply myself. And I've been thinking as a few things have come together in terms of my own life, my work, some of the things I am doing, I guess, in a professional capacity. I've been given a little bit of space to sort of zoom out and look at the landscape of what's ahead of me. And I'm looking for those mountains. I'm looking for the challenge. I'm looking for the big fish. And how do I go about finding that? How do I catch that? How do I get on that, path? And it seems the things that were interesting me, let's say 10 or 15 years ago, this journey through the city of photography, of trying to find myself in that world, a lot of that has sort of fallen away. It's sort of, I think of it like I've sort of shed the skin of that person that I was. And that isn't to say that I'm not doing those things anymore, or that I don't, that they're not part of me. You know, certainly the work and the creative work I did over the last few years is, or the last few decades even, you could say, it's left an impression on me. It's formed who I am today. But I'm not playing the same game as the old days. And it's interesting because a lot of people still know me for that stuff, even though I don't necessarily do it still in the same way. At the same time, I think the world has changed. I mean, this is a conversation we've had around the death of the image. You know, I mean, I was always a photographer. Well, that was. I mean, I started photography at a certain point in time, but before that, I was always a visual person. Even like I was always looking, and I was thinking about things in their visual context. But something's happened over the last few years where I think our relationship with images has changed. And as I said, I've called it the death of the image. The Instagramification of it, the timeline, the scroll. No one looks at things anymore. And this really stands out to me when I walk around, especially now. It's a busy time of year. It's sakura, cherry blossom season. It's very crowded with people visiting where I live, and they're not actually looking. They're not seeing anything. They're not using their eyes. And I think the AI stuff is a little piece of that. I'm not really too, I don't have a super strong opinion about that, but certainly it has added to this question of like, what is an image? What does it mean to render something? What does it mean to hallucinate something? What does it mean to even look at something? We haven't really got a clear, concept for that anymore. And maybe you could argue the whole of modernity, and certainly the last maybe 100 years and photography has been pushing that question. I mean, photography is probably a bit longer than that, maybe let's say 150 years. What is an image? And I actually had an interesting experience just the other day. A friend of mine, who I respect quite a lot, came around here, and we did a wet plate photograph, which took about 1 hour to set up. And he had a small tent and the medium format camera, and he had all his chemicals, and he actually painted the chemical concoction onto the glass plate, and then was able to put it into this camera with the bellows and this old Zeiss lens and set it all up. And we got a photograph with this these silver salts, and he was able to develop it there. And he took the photo. It was about a 10-second exposure in the middle of the day, and then he took it straight into the tent and was able to develop it there and fix it. And the whole process, it was about an hour and a half, and we got one photo out of it. And it's a very low resolution, to use the modern terminology, but what was profound though about that process though is that the etchings on that glass plate have a direct physical relationship with me sitting there getting my photo taken. And it's even a more direct relationship than what you would get with film, right? Because film is usually negative prints, like prints from a negative. You're still a couple of steps from the actual the physicality of it, but the actual thing that I have just over here is literally the glass plate that was in the camera with the salt chemical concoction that resolved my image. And I thought, wow, this is perhaps the most real photograph that I've ever seen. It's the most accurate, truthful representation of reality. And it's interesting because it's a little bit blurry. There's sort of some marks around the outside. There's some flecks missing from my forehead, and there's bits on it that are quite ambiguous. It's almost like a memory, and it's of course black and white with these silver salts. There's no color. There's very little depth of field. It's very blurry, and it's perhaps the most real photograph though that I've ever had taken of me, certainly, and that I've ever been part of the process of. I wasn't the one who took the photograph, but I was there, part of the process, watching eagerly as this wet plate print was prepared with very much a magical concoction. My friend was pouring these chemicals and sort of just guessing and sort of looking up at the angle of the sun and the shadows and trying to work with it as the sun started to move behind the tree and change the lay of the light. It was quite a profound experience. And here I am with my 80 megapixel digital cameras, my lenses, and this high precision raw files that have unlimited depth to them. And I think, I've kind of had enough of that. That's not real anymore. Those images are dead to me. And perhaps the most real was this ancient process. Well, I say ancient, I'd say 100 and something years ago, 150 years ago, but that was quite a profound experience. And I've been reflecting on that because, you know, my whole work, my whole body of work until now has been this kind of digital ephemeria, you could say. In fact, I spend way too much time on my computer. And part of just today thinking about things and kind of getting out of the house was saying, look, I have to take a break from the machine. You know, all my work, just looking even just here in front of me now, my files and my documents, they're all there inside the machine. But at the same time, I mean, this is just a point in time when that's possible. If I take all of that away, we remove the computer, we remove the internet, we remove the technology, I am basically unskilled labor. I don't have the physical tactile knowledge, the tactile intelligence to be able to do many things, you know. And this is part of my reflections on, you know, what is vocation? What does it mean to be able to build a tent, or to be a carpenter, or to be a gardener, or to be able to cook food professionally? These kinds of things. You know, there's all these physical jobs, physical occupations that maybe people don't see as valuable. Well, they're not valued certainly in the current world. Yet they are so much more important. Even the most important job of all, perhaps the job of mother, of raising children, is undervalued. It's not in the financial economy. And this leads to sort of my thinking over recent weeks. As you may know, I've been diving deep into this idea of neoliberalism, of the economic wave, the we could say revolution even, that swept over the world since the 1980s, of changes in the way we conceptualize our relationship between ourselves and the state, the relationship between state and private sector. You could argue the relationship between global capital and labor. And I've been reading more and more into this, into the literature exploring this, which, as I've spoken about before, neoliberalism is perhaps one of the most important things of our time, and one of the most, you know, has had the most impact on our life. We can all feel its impact. Yet most people don't really know what it is. It's this kind of elephant in the room that maybe in academic circles people are aware of it vaguely. They've read maybe a book about it, but it's not talked about with what I think is the real imminence and gravity of what it has done to our modern conceptions of work, of occupation, of value. You know, the financialization of the economy over the last 30, 40 years, the development of these financial capitals, the ability to send change or send these ripples out into the world merely with, you know, the push of a button on a computer keyboard, moving these numbers around on these spreadsheets and these mainframes and these banking systems. It's quite a profound thing to really consider. And I think the closest we got to maybe a consciousness of that was the Occupy Wall Street moment around, you know, around 2008, which also happens to be around about the same time that Bitcoin was developed and released. There was, I think, an emergence, a sort of a spike in kind of people's awareness of that, that, you know, the shower thought that maybe there's something going on here. But I think since then that has, the tide has gone back out, and people sort of forgotten that there was something there, that there was some questions to ask, and instead we've become caught up in what we are in today, which is the throes of global capital. And I throw that word around, which has Marxist connotations, but certainly when you reflect on the situation of the banking system, the financialization of everything, the new innovation of these prediction markets, where you can, you know, you can see with some certainty what's going to happen with foreign policy before any announcements are made, because somebody knows, and so they've made a bet about it on a prediction market, and the markets never lie, or do they? I don't know. There's this kind of strangeness to it all, and it's a strangeness that prompts people, very intelligent people, to take up occupations in that world. you know, this financial world of global capital is a very alluring and lucrative place to work. Yet fundamentally, just like much of the work I'm doing downstream as the, you know, a so-called information worker with my soft hands, there's no tactile knowledge, there's no reality to it. And so I'm amazed and kind of in awe at this, you could call it this kind of magical grammar of global capital, the way it just sort of makes things happen. It can move value around, it can activate, and this is one of the magics of capital historically even, is that it can animate, you know, the fallow field or the derelict factory can be kind of animated by capital. It can be revitalized. In a sense, we've just been reading the stories of Palm Sunday, the story of Lazarus. There's a kind of messianic power even, in a dark sense, to be able to bring to life things with global capital. And I don't want to try and give it the religious connotations, but it certainly, in our modern secular world, it's unfortunate, but it's taken on those kinds of powers. It's able to stimulate an economy. It's able to bring about change. It's able to overthrow presidents and regimes. It's able to direct war in its own logic. And so we see this unfolding mess in the Middle East, which has always kind of been over there. It's just far away from most of the people around me's consciousness to be kind of a little bit distant. But I've gone deeper. I've tried to talk to people about this. I had someone recently on my show from Iran, who was a former diplomat from Iran from before the revolution, and he told me a lot about this deep, long history. Places like Hamadan, these ancient cities, Isfahan, these beautiful places. And it strikes me that my friend who took the wet plate photograph, Japanese friend of mine, he came around into this very room that evening, and we had this long conversation about his travels through the Middle East. He had been in Iran many years ago, about the hospitality, about the beautiful and profound moments he had on that journey. And it just struck me that there's this depth to that experience that he had. There was a reality to it, of having tea with somebody, being invited into someone's house, to be at the right time at the right place, to have an encounter in a profoundly human way. And perhaps this death of the image that I'm talking about, in a sense, maybe this is the outcome of global capital, of squinting your eyes, or having the scales in your eyes, this kind of blurry, translucent veil that hangs over everything, that gives a sort of sense that you can kind of feel that there's still structure. We still see familiar institutions and names and brands, but whatever is behind them has sort of decayed and rotted away, perhaps. And so my intuition around my work is, over these last few years, and certainly this year, I've been moving away from the image. I've been trying to move away from the digital as much as it keeps me busy, and it's still important to my own ability to put food on the table. But you know, how do we make it more real? Because the realest thing we can get with photographs is maybe what we did with this wet plate photograph. But even then, it's still a rendering of reality. But what does it mean to actually encounter reality, to be out there in the mess of it all? What does it mean to be able to build things, to be able to have a tactile knowledge of the implicit knowledge of materials, of things, of people, to be out in the world? I don't know. I'm motivated to learn more about this and to ponder it all. I think a intellectual academic mind is useful here, but it can also be a hindrance. I think you kind of have to have a little bit of both. I think our long walks, our long discussions that we have together, that I'm very lucky to be able to have with other friends as well, mean I'm able to, I think, conceptualize things that would otherwise not be given voice. And once you can start talking about something, I think you can start adding to it. You can start building it up as an idea that can you can carry with you. And I think that is important. I think we're given these minds, and we need to put them to work just as much as we put our bodies to work. But coming back to this, you know, this kind of stream of consciousness, where did this come from? This idea of taking a shower, of being in the shower room with the steam and the water, and the moment of quiet, the moment of, I guess, quietness of the soul, because certainly there's noise around me, but there's moments in there where you can really just kind of pull on these threads, these ideas that sit in that flow. I often think of that metaphor of the river, of it being like a river. And you can sort of pull on these threads, and certainly it seems like we're in interesting times. Look, I don't know. I think I watch too much from the news. I have to find some better ways to work with that. But there's something going on, and I don't know whether it's coming up to 2,000 years since the crucifixion. We're coming up to perhaps what some people would call a fourth turning, or a change in regime, the decline of an empire. There's many ways of framing it, but something's happening, and I think more than ever, an engagement with reality, seeing your neighbor, looking and smelling and touching and feeling reality, is more important than ever. It's so important to ground our experience with that that lived real life here and now, but also maybe just having a little bit of space for more serious consideration of the eternal, of that space beyond time and place, and carrying both of those things with you. It's a hard thing to do, and I don't know if it fully makes sense. Maybe this is just my musings on a Friday evening, but it seems to me that just a little bit of balance there, a little bit of sight, and a little bit of curiosity perhaps is important to carry with us. And I'm reminded of these stories of these images of, I say that word image, interesting, but these stories of the washing away of the scales from the eyes, the spiritual washing, the sacrament of holy baptism, these moments of clarity. And I only hope that we can have more of these together. I look forward to more conversations. I look forward to being able to act and be agentic, to use an AI term, to be agentic in the world, to bring about the best that I can do, to be the hands and feet of God here on earth, here and now, and to do the best I can. I look forward to having another conversation with you soon, but I thought I'd record this just to share some thoughts on that. So I wish you all the best, and I look forward to talking again soon.